We do have a quorum. First item on the agenda is approval of the minutes. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes? Representative Sundin.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we approve the minutes of February 17th, 2019.
It's been moved to approve the minutes of February 17th, 2020. It says 2019 on here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'll note that it should say 2020.
Oh, man.
So that's one correction. I have already made it for the minutes. Are there any other correction for the minutes?
I'm going to check the spelling on my name. Now we're good to go.
Okay. All right. All in favor of approving the minutes as corrected, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Members, today we've got a couple of items on the agenda. One is going to be a presentation on the governor's water quality infrastructure bonding. This is not meant as a review of each individual project, but more as an overview. However, we do have people here to help answer questions as we go forward. So today we'll start off. The first person we'll have up is Mr. Jeff Freeman from the Public Facilities Authority. And you'll find that there are a number of items in your packet on the presentations. Mr. Freeman, if you'd like to identify yourself and start with your presentation, I would appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon, members. So since we've got several agencies lined up, we thought we'd kind of speed things along by having the on-deck person sit up here, too, if that's all right.
Thank you. We appreciate that.
So my name is Jeff Freeman. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Public Facilities Authority. We are the state agency that provides financing to cities for wastewater and drinking water infrastructure projects through several different loan and grant programs. PFA provides funding for all types of municipal water infrastructure, including replacement of the aging infrastructure and treatment upgrades. PFA programs are designed to work together in a coordinated funding framework with low-interest loans that are broadly available to cities of all sizes throughout the state, and supplemental grant programs that are targeted to specific projects based on affordability and to upgrade treatment plants to meet more stringent permit requirements. The governor has recommended a total of $200 million for PFA programs, and you should have in your packet our handout with multicolored sheets. The first sheet summarizes the governor's recommendations. The first request is $25 million. To provide the required 20% state match to the federal capitalization grants that go into the state revolving loan funds. The Clean Water and Drinking Water Revolving Funds are the PFA's largest source of project funding. Last year, PFA awarded $195 million to over 50 projects throughout the state in low-interest loans. This $25 million request will match 2 years of estimated federal funding and help to build future lending capacity. The second request is $100 million for the Water Infrastructure Funding, or WIF, grant program. WIF grants are based on affordability criteria that focused on the cost per household for the wastewater drinking water system, which means the grants generally go to small communities because they have fewer users to spread the costs over. WIF grants are packaged with PFA loans or can be used to co-fund projects with our federal partner, USDA Rural Development, that funds water projects in small rural communities with similar loan grant programs. The third request is $75 million for the Point Source Implementation Grant Program, or PSIG grants. Those grants help cities upgrade water treatment facilities to reduce the discharge of specific pollutants, to meet permit requirements and address specific water quality goals. Reducing the discharge of phosphorus is the most common one, but there are other pollutants as well. All of the PFA programs follow project priority lists from the Pollution Control Agency or the Department of Health, what that rank project's based on, age and condition, as well as water quality and public health criteria. Funding is not awarded until the projects receive all the necessary approvals and are ready to start construction. And I won't go through all of the sheets, but I just want to kind of quickly explain what's here. So the green sheets are show the current clean water project priority list, which is primarily wastewater projects. The PCA develops this priority list, projects ranked 1 through 239 based on the PCA criteria. PCA prepared this list last summer. It's an annual process. They prepare the priority list and then turn it over to the PFA, and we start lining up projects with what they're eligible for in terms of the various funding programs as well as the readiness to proceed. It's important to note that this whole list is essentially a five-year list of projects. So some of these projects are in the very early stages of planning and may take several years before they're ready for construction. Others are much further along, and some have already taken bids and started construction, and that is noted by the gray rows that go all the way across. Those are projects that we have funded now since the beginning of the fiscal year and are under construction. Call your attention to column six is the CWRF loan, 2020 IUP requested loans. The IUP is the intended use plan. It's our list of projects that are eligible to apply for and receive loans. The projects with dollar amounts shown in that column have submitted a request with a proposed schedule to complete the design work and be ready for construction by the end of this fiscal year. The total at the end on page six is of almost $400 million in requested loans, and the PFA will make those loans to all of the cities that complete the review and approval process. We know that projects get delayed for a variety of reasons, so we don't expect all 400 to go ahead. Last year, we made loans for about, on the clean water side, about $117 million. In addition to the loans, some projects are eligible for supplemental grants to offset some of the debt, and the green sheets show the different grant programs, eligibility, our estimated eligibility for those programs. We'll continue to review loan applications this spring as new applications come in. Additional eligible projects may be identified for the WIF program. The PSIG grants are based on applications that were received in July, where cities self-identified their projects as being eligible for those PSIG grants to upgrade treatment facilities, and those have not yet all been verified and confirmed by the Pollution Control Agency. So that process will continue here through the spring. Columns on the far right show our funding partners, USDA, Rural Development in particular, and as I mentioned, we do co-fund projects with them using the WIF grants. After the green sheets, there's a breakout sheet for the WIF program. There's a separate breakout sheet for the PSIG program. Those showed more detail and show really how the project readiness to proceed factors into the funding process. So projects that were approved at the end of last fiscal year and are now in the final stages of bidding and getting ready for construction are in the first category, identified as 2019 carryover projects, followed by 2020 potential WIF needs, projects on this year's IUP that at this point have been identified as potential WIF eligible projects, along with the projects that Rural Development expects to fund this year or is working toward funding. And then finally, other potential WIF needs, projects on that five-year list that could come forward in a future year. Similar with the PSIG list, both of these lists show a dotted line. That dotted line indicates how far the current funding, available funding from prior appropriations, how far down the list that would go for these projects, and then all of the projects below the dotted line will require additional appropriations. There's blue sheets that indicate the drinking, or show the drinking water project priority list. So these are all the drinking water projects the cities have applied for, and it's laid out in a similar fashion, along with a drinking water WIF breakout sheet, and then the yellow sheets in each section provide an alphabetical listing so you can look up any specific project you might be interested in and then cross-reference where it's at on the green or blue sheets as far as potential funding. And with that, Mr. Chair, I know time is tight. I'll stop there and be happy to answer any questions.
Does anyone have any questions for Mr. Freeman right offhand? Representative Sundin.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Freeman, not to get too personal with anybody in the room, but would you drink that water?
Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sundin, I would decline.
Okay.
Representative Sundin.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for the answer. It's an honest answer. I'm just wondering who in the heck would want to come to Carlton County and start a business over by the intersection of Highway 210 and I-35 with water quality such as that. It's a detriment to the health of the people in that area and an impediment for further business development in that I-35 corridor. So please take note that we're disappointed that the Twin Lakes Carlton water project is not included in the government's governor's recs. Very disappointed.
Thank you, Mr. Sundin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sundin, I know the Twin Lakes project is on the priority list, has been for some time. We previously funded a treatment plant project for the city of Carlton that is sized to be able to provide additional water to that area. The project for, as identified as Twin Lakes Township, they've applied to USDA Rural Development, I believe, and they're moving through their process. And potentially, if there's a grant need that Rural Development identifies, we could still do the matching grant, as I mentioned, with the WIF program. So that project is still moving through the process.
Thank you for your concerns. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any other questions? Mr. Freeman, thank you at this time. And then next we'll move on to Ms. Kessler. If you'd like to introduce yourself, and we will grab the right.
Good afternoon, Kessler, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Katrina Kessler, the Assistant Commissioner at the MPCA for Water and Agriculture. Thank you for the opportunity to be here this afternoon to present the agency's water bonding proposals. I will discuss two proposals that were developed in response to needs that we heard directly from our municipal and local government partners as they are working through their work to provide assistance at the local level to protect human health and the environment, which directly aligns with our mission. As you likely know, these are the core products and services of the MPCA, and the two bonding proposals align with a number of these, but most immediately, they're related to our water permitting work, as well as our work to support local governments in their efforts to plan and maximize public investments to prevent pollution. This is the first proposal. It would create a new grant program to advance work by the local units of government to increase resilience of their stormwater infrastructure. We're calling this Sustainable Communities and Climate Resilience, and the proposal is for $15 million. More than 60% of Americans think that climate change is a crisis or a serious problem, and the majority of Americans think that action needs to be taken right now to address climate change. One of the main reasons, or one of the main impacts that climate change is happening on Minnesota can be seen in the flows of our receiving waters and the flows that are overwhelming our aging stormwater infrastructure. Between 1951 and 2012, the total precipitation in the Twin Cities metro area increased by 20%. And this is seen not only in the spring and autumn, but also across months that provide put additional strain on our infrastructure. And the impacts are not limited to the Twin Cities metro area. In greater Minnesota, we are also experiencing much heavier rains more frequently, and they cause flooding and result in crop damage, as evidenced by the last year, as well as business and private property damage. The increase was most dramatic in the last 5 years, and as you may know, 2019 was the wettest year on record. So we are not experiencing any relief from this. And looking into the future, many of the climate models indicate that these patterns and distribution of rainfall and snowfall will continue to change. We're likely to get more intense, heavy storms and resulting in more flooding. Sudden and intense floods can result in private and public infrastructure damage. And this proposal would support communities already struggling with the challenges to design and implement resilience stormwater projects where they already are overwhelmed by aging infrastructure challenges. To inform the development of this bonding proposal, we surveyed 260 entities about the stormwater climate resilience needs through a survey that was sent to a list in December of 2019. Many of the communities expressed a need for more sustainable and more resilient stormwater infrastructure and funding for projects to mitigate risks and impacts of extreme weather events. This slide describes the eligible projects that would include projects to create or increase storage capacity, projects to slow water down through additional infiltration, restore floodplains, look at stormwater reuse systems, wetland restoration, as well as things like bioretention, tree trenches, and underground infiltration systems. There would also be eligibility for projects that decreased impervious surface or increased stormwater conveyance capacity. So we know that we want to slow water down and store it on the landscape. We also know that additional capacity and larger pipes are needed in some locations. So larger inlets or structures that would dissipate the energy of more intense flows. The funding for the pilot, so this is the initial effort, and we are looking at public infrastructure. I think the handouts that you have call out energy, and one of the things that we're thinking about is if we could expand this over time to include more resilience types works, but recognizing that we have talked to our permitted partners and that the need really is in the stormwater arena right now, we're going to start with this, and we think that we would be able to fund between 5 to 10 projects across the state. And these projects could be done in communities that are permitted municipal separate storm sewer permits, so medium to smaller size to larger size communities, as well as communities that don't hold permits with the MPCA, so that would not be a eligibility factor. You would be able to apply as long as you were a local unit of government. So that's the first one. The next one is related also to our stormwater infrastructure and would set up a $2 million grant opportunity for local units of government to accelerate pond sediment removal. So stormwater ponds, which we know are across the state in small to medium and large size communities, we have the slide says approximately 20,000 public stormwater ponds, have to be maintained by removing the sediment that accumulates to make sure that they perform not only their water quality function, but as well as their water quantity function to store water and prevent damage from flooding. Legacy use of polyaromatic hydrocarbons, or PAHs, are a challenge because although these have been phased out and are no longer legal for use in the state, there's legacy contamination. That means that if you have pond sediment that can't be dredged and reused, that it would have to go to a landfill. And we know that dredging occurs on average roughly every 20 years. So even though this has been phased out in the last 10 years, there's legacy contamination in many stormwater ponds across the state. And we want to make sure that we are supportive of communities who might be facing additional maintenance costs. Past experience has shown that costs to clean up ponds and dispose of pH contaminated sediments in landfills raises the cost by approximately 30%. When we did a similar effort in 2012, we were able to, with a similar grant, we were able to help communities, and those costs range between $110,000 to $1.5 million. So there's a big range depending on what type of pond it is, how large it is, where it is, what the concentrations of pHs that you're seeing. And as I mentioned, as of January 1st, 2014, the sale or use of coal tar-based pavement sealants with PHs was banned. And that has gone a long way, but the legacy contamination still exists. So similar to the other bonding proposal, we did a survey in partnership with the Mini-City Stormwater Coalition to assess the need for this type of assistance. Survey respondents indicated that samples collected in 180 ponds showed that roughly 30% were still contaminated by PAHs at a level that would have required disposal in a landfill. So funds would directly help these communities maintain a critical component of their stormwater infrastructure so that they could continue to provide the essential water quality service to that community. That is my last slide.
Questions? Representative Sundin. I mean Sandell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about stormwater runoff. In suburban communities where development seems to be brisk, the issue of stormwater runoff is a growing concern, not only to people who are in homes now and the roads are being expanded, but also for communities that are growing very rapidly with developments of 150 or 180 homes. What sort of responsibility does a developer or the city have to make sure that the future is going to be able to accommodate the increased stormwater runoff that's a real issue?
Ms. Kessler.
Mr. Chair and Representative, so that's an excellent question, and I think it's a two-part. Certainly at the most immediate time, the developer has to get a construction stormwater permit. Any entity who does disturb more than an acre of land has to apply for a permit by the MPCA, and oftentimes there is a local watershed district that also has permitting authority that would require them to install best management practices to manage runoff that is associated with construction. But your larger question about what is the responsibility of an urban, suburban, or community across the state to manage stormwater capacity and its infrastructure over time is a more complicated question. Certainly, communities have to think with their comprehensive plan what size is necessary for their right-of-way, but also to support development. And there's different ways to do that. You can design a larger system that would support a big development and then parse the cost out as development occurs, but that requires upfront capital investment by somebody like the city, or if there's one core developer who can fund that and then get paid back over time. Sometimes watershed districts can serve as that function too, and you get a regional system, which takes advantage of economies of scale such that each individual development doesn't have to create its own stormwater system. It also gives you the opportunity to think about something more innovative like reuse or treatment at a larger scale that could then be an amenity towards that development overall. So depending on where that community is located and how engaged that community's public works or city planning effort is or regional planning, you're going to see a menu of choices.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sandell, anything else?
Thank you. That's fine.
Representative Sundin.
I'm not going to ask you if you're thirsty. But one of the greatest concerns that came to me was the use of tire-derived aggregate in roadbeds and for fill around new construction, new houses, that type of thing. And I got into that issue and did some reading. National Geographic did a good article on it, and they said up to 80% of the plastics that are free in the environment are coming from car tires, truck tires, whatever. In the life of one vehicle or one set of tires, they lose about 10 pounds of rubber and plastic that's mixed into the rubber. I'm just wondering, in the stormwater runoffs, is that being measured? And any thoughts on controlling that?
Ms. Kessler.
Mr. Chair and Representative, also a really good question. Your reference makes total sense to me. We know that there's plastic contamination broadly in all waters, and that's not unique to a stormwater pond or a lake or a stream or Lake Superior or the ocean. Unfortunately, it is a challenge that faces all of us. Some of the work we're doing at the state across agencies is looking at ways to characterize the extent of microplastics in the waters here. Currently, that scope does not include stormwater pond monitoring, but I can tell you that inasmuch as stormwater ponds are designed to slow water down, much like some of the other stormwater infrastructure I talked about, and capture sediment, and then that sediment would then be dredged out and removed and reused or landfilled, depending on what the makeup of that sediment was, that it would be captured, some of it, but some of it probably not, because it's floatable. Like, we've seen that in some of the research shows that these are very, very tiny. You wouldn't be able to see it, and it's not going to sink to the bottom of a stormwater pond, and that's when you have to think about other types of treatment. And certainly there are other types of treatment out there that are available for stormwater facilities. There are filters. There are more mechanical type treatment options, but they're very often energy intensive and very maintenance intensive, and you have to balance the needs of a city in terms of the capital investment up front that it might cost to install that, as well as the maintenance over time. It's a big challenge.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. I'm glad it's on your radar screen. Let's keep it there until we find a solution.
Okay. And Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kessler, just wondering, we're hearing some conversation in your presentation about this stormwater pond sediment cleanup effort. I'm assuming all of that material is going directly into a landfill, but I don't know. You might have said it, but I could have missed it.
Ms. Kessler.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the goal is that the sediment doesn't have to go into a landfill, but there, when we know that through sampling there are levels that are above risk-based values that might be a concern for reuse, whether that's in road aggregate or some other reuse, it does need to go into a landfill, and the second bonding proposal would directly help those communities. And we think it's approximately 30% of the stormwater ponds out there still have legacy pH is above the level by which they wouldn't have to be, like the 30% would have to be landfilled at this point, is our estimate. So approximately 70% of the sediment removed across the state, if you go by that logic, doesn't have to go to a landfill.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to just think about my own situations. What are we looking at a typical lifespan of a pond before, or a hole in the ground, whatever the situation might be? How much time are we talking about between our lifespan and those situations?
Ms. Kessler.
Mr. Chair and Representative, it's a good question. On average, stormwater ponds need to be dredged out every 20 years. And so we know that since the phase out happened in 2014, there's still legacy contamination in ponds that saw pH reuse or pH use. And certainly 20 years is just an average, and that different size ponds or different depths of ponds may need to be dredged out more frequently or less frequently.
Okay. Further questions? Ms. Kessler, I do have one for you. And this is going back to the pilot programs that you're looking at for the sustainable communities and climate resilience. From what I was understanding, you were mentioning that you're looking targeting smaller communities, smaller to mid-sized communities, and this would be a local match type situation. Is this like working in joint with the local soil water districts, or what are the things that are going to be looked at in that type of frame?
Mr. Chair, good question. Anyone who is a local unit of government would be eligible, and certainly soil and water conservation districts that would partner with the municipality or the township or the county would be eligible for this. Watershed districts, watershed management organizations. We want to make sure that we're as flexible as possible as we build this, recognizing that the need is great and that we want to be able to maximize the public investment in this first go-round.
Sounds very intriguing. I will look forward to updates on this in the future once these pilot projects start rolling out to see what kind of impact they're having. At this point in time, I would say that would be it for the Pollution Control Agency. Thank you, Ms. Kessler. And then next, it looks like we have Ms. Becker-Kadelka from Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Mr. Chair, members, Angie Becker-Kadelka, Assistant Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources.
Thank you, and go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members, the mission of the Board of Water and Soil Resources, or BOWSER, is to improve and protect Minnesota's water and soil resources by working in partnership with local organizations and with private landowners. Our business model is really focused on private lands, and that is because around 75% of the state is in private land ownership. And we do this through the local government conservation delivery system, recognizing that soil and water districts and watershed, soil and water conservation districts and watershed districts and counties have staff that live and work in the places that they are also living and working with those private landowners. All of this means that there are on-the-ground results, so these are the actual conservation practices that happen. So for bonding, the governor's recommendation includes two recommendations through the Board of Water and Soil Resources, $26.4 million into the local road wetland replacement program, and $16.5 million for the Minnesota CREP. So if we start with the local road wetland replacement program, in 1996, the legislature passed a law that mandated that the state of Minnesota replace wetlands that are lost due to certain road projects. And so on the left, this is a local road project where the road was being widened. It impacted a wetland. And so that local road authority contacts the state via BOWSER to replace the wetland that is impacted. The benefits to local road authorities and to local road projects are both economic and environmental. So economically, it provides local road authorities streamlined permitting. The state takes care of both the federal and the state requirements. It becomes predictable and cost-effective to achieve the necessary wetland mitigation. It also makes higher quality wetlands. So rather than just going into a road right-of-way and replacing that impact for each road, as a result, the state can combine different road projects and create higher quality wetlands in one area. What does it cost? The average cost of a wetland credit. When BOWSER or the state develops the wetland credit, we can do it cheaper than if it's part of a private bank. And there's also some numbers here that we've researched on what our neighboring state and nationally cost for wetland credits. And roughly one credit equals around 1 acre of impact. So right now, the problem or the issue is that we have this perennial issue of credit shortage. And this is something that's been going on and that this committee and others have looked at for the last several years. Right now, as of January 2020, we have zero credits available in four of our bank service areas. And a bank service area is around, it's about a basin. If you look at the map next to it, it's about a basin geography. And so four of the bank service areas have no credits available to them right now. This is in part because of a perennial underfunding of the program. So as the state, we can only ask for the resources that we would use in a given time period. We never ask for more. And you'll see there the need compared to the bonding appropriation over the last 10 years. In 2017, the program also was running a deficit, and so the legislature infused a short-term general fund cash contribution of $5 million in 2017, and that was so that the state, instead of developing credits, could go out and buy credits so that road projects wouldn't be shut down. And so that that process means that the credits cost more money, but then they are there right away, because developing a credit may take anywhere from 5 to 8 years, because it's not until the easement is acquired, the land is then restored, the acres are seeded and planted, and then the wetland becomes functioning, that's when those credits are finally available, which can take several years. So with this projection, without additional funding, the local road wetland replacement program balance continues to go down. So again, the governor's bonding recommendation is $26.4 million. And just as a wrap-up, this is an example of a wetland bank, and this is in Murray County in southwest Minnesota, and this is called the Hansen Wetland Bank. And so this one, for example, is 57 acres of wetland credit that has been developed over the last several years. So in our second program, the Minnesota Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program. The Minnesota CREP takes two different programs. It's the federal CRP, or Conservation Reserve Program, and the state RIM Reserve Program, and combines them together, and that makes the Minnesota CREP. The strength of this program is that it is voluntary, and so landowners choose to sign up into this program. And it's targeted. It focuses in on those marginal areas of land and riparian areas that are only on three conservation practices: buffers, wetlands, and then wellhead areas for drinking water. As of today, we have 24,000 acres enrolled in the program. We've had two summers where the federal government has opened the enrollment period for CREP. We had some delay there when they were working on farm bill rules. But so two summers, and so in those two summers, we have had 24,000 acres enrolled so far. So funding for the Minnesota CREP, the state is on track to reach the state contribution of $175 million. This unlocks that up to $350 million of federal dollars that go right into the state and right out to directly to landowner payments. And so so this year, the capital investment request is $16.5 million, and that would actually complete the state's contribution. What we've learned so far is that CREP applicants sign up for this voluntary program for lots of different reasons. So this is Wayne Nelson. He's in Freeborn County, and he signed up for it for habitat benefits. This program is funded through four different funds, one of them being the Outdoor Heritage Fund, and that it made sense for him financially. We also know that the Minnesota CREP provides economic drivers. And so, for example, the federal money goes right out to landowners. The state makes an easement payment to the landowners and provides restoration costs. And then it's up to the landowner to go ahead and hire contractors, to go buy seed, to restore the wetland, which keeps that money moving and circulating right there in the region. There's also clean water benefits. And so you'll see on your screen, so far these 24,000 acres, when those projects are completed, have different reductions, and you'll see phosphorus, sediment, nitrogen, and greenhouse gases. And the benefits then to Minnesotans are really around this idea of multiple benefits or stacked benefits. So it keeps soil on the land, it provides temporary water storage in some places. In some places it protects vulnerable drinking water, it enhances grassland, it enhances wetland habitat, and it sequesters carbon. With that, are there any questions?
Okay, questions. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just here again, this might have already been mentioned, but I'm looking at the schedule for today. And is Director Jasky coming in?
I'll ask Ms. Becker-Kadelka. Will Mr. Jasky be joining us today?
Mr. Chair and members, it's just me today.
Okay. Representative Heintzman.
I do have a couple of questions that aren't related to this issue, so I can wait until the rest of the committee weighs in on these issues. But
okay. Okay, very good. Any other questions on these issues here? I do have two. One is backing up when you're talking about the local roads wetland replacement. There were several areas that had zeros, and I saw two others where they were real low on the credits there. Does that mean that right now we've got projects that are holding up, or are they going out of the national market and purchasing their credits through there? What's happening in those situations?
Mr. Chair, it's a really good question. And so in 2017, when the legislature directed us to open up all of the bank service areas again with that $5 million in general fund, the other thing that the legislature did is to, and they said, don't close down bank service areas. Instead, make sure that you keep funding projects. And so when there's no credits in one area, we work with the federal government and find another area that's acceptable. However, there's a higher credit ratio. So instead of just a regular or one-to-one ratio, it might be a two-to-one ratio. So there have been no projects that have been stopped as of today. And I've asked our staff if there's any in this spring construction season, and they said the time that we're spending on credits faster now, and then the time that we know that we're going to be unable to do projects, road projects, is for fall construction season.
Okay. Another question I have on it is, With the request that is out there, how many acres approximately do you think will be, end up that will be able to purchase with that with those dollars?
Are you, Mr. Chair, are you referring to the local road program?
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Chair, so in acquiring easements, the state ends up using around 170, 171 credits a year. That's been the historical average. And so that 171 credits historically has cost somewhere in the neighborhood, depending on what type of wetland area, somewhere in the neighborhood of around $5.5 to $6 million. And so in order to get back on track, recognizing that it takes 5 to 8 years for a wetland to become viable, for those credits to be used, we are about 4 years behind in funding. So we know we're going to still be taking a nosedive, even if there's money that comes in today, because it takes a while for those wetland credits to form. And so this 26.4 will get us back on track to just the where we need to be 5 years from now.
Okay. All right. Thank you. That addressed the question I had. Appreciate it. And then one other question I had, now this is going to CREP. On the amount that we've got coming in, you've got the you were mentioned that the state contribution will end up being 175, which lacks the 350 from the feds. Now we've got, if I understood, 24,000 acres in the program right now.
Mm-hmm.
So when it's all built out with all these dollars, what does that end up bringing the total, approximately the total acreage to enroll to CREP at that point?
Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chair, we'll know more as the acres come in. So it depends if there's a lot of small easements, if landowners are interested in filter strips, or bigger easements if the landowners are interested in more wetland restoration. And so it's a little hard to predict right now. The federal government has capped us at 60,000 acres total.
All right, thank you. And then Representative Heinzman, you said you had other questions, but they were not related to the subject. Why don't we hold on till we get through everything else and we can see where we are on that part? We've got a couple more to present, and we've got Mr. Stark to present on the water recommendation. So I just want to make sure that we don't run out of time. So I'm just kind of...
Just want to confirm then, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Do we believe the director will be coming into some of the environment committees? Because I can wait until that happens. But I don't know when we're going to have another opportunity. I haven't seen his schedule. Maybe Peter would know more on that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Ms. Becker-Kadelka.
And members, we would be glad to come, and Director Jasky sends his regrets today. We'd be glad to come and meet with you as well if that would be helpful.
And one of the questions I'll also mention out there is we have the bill that Representative Torkelson has introduced on the holding the water and the land in the Minnesota River Valley. I would think that maybe if Commissioner Jasky could be there at that point in time, or Director Jasky could be there at that point in time, because I believe you serve on that committee too, right, Mr. Heinzman?
Right.
Would that work out?
Right. Well, there is some stuff that probably does need to get discussed, so... I'm not sure that a private meeting would work. We're trying to figure out what some of the solutions might be in the Sauk River Watershed District. Mm-hmm. And it's been quite a public conversation with some very significant meetings. So at some point, that should be discussed on the record.
Okay. I'll make note of it, and we'll see where we are as we get through everything else.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Thank you, Mr. Heinzman, Representative Heinzman. Okay, thank you, Ms. Becker-Kadelka. And then next we have Ms. Garlitz from the Department of Natural Resources.
Members of the committee, Mr. Chair, my name is Annalie Garlitz, and I'm with the Department of Natural Resources. Thank you for the invitation to come today to talk about our water and wastewater infrastructure requests as they relate to bonding. I'm going to start by talking about our overall DNR capital assets. our approach to capital investment, and then, as I said, the 2020 requests as they relate to water issues. DNR has categorized our bonding requests into shared priorities by the DNR and the governor. These are under public safety and asset preservation, which includes taking care of what we have, which includes facilities, buildings, and DNR infrastructure, as well as quality of life that ensures access to Minnesotans and preserving our natural and cultural heritage. DNR assets are diverse, and unlike other state assets, caring for these different assets and pieces that are out there on the land requires a different approach. Some examples of these owned natural resource assets that don't include lakes, rivers, the waters of the state are buildings. DNR manages visitor centers, cabins, fish hatcheries, offices, storage buildings, shower buildings, and historic buildings. There are also natural resources such as WMAs, AMAs, SNAs, and state forests, state parks. And then there's other things such as roads, bridges, trail bridges, water control structures, dams, campgrounds, public water accesses, and fishing piers in our portfolio. So as you can see, it's quite diverse. DNR assets are extensive and geographically dispersed. We have a presence in 87 counties. We manage 5.6 million acres of land. And DNR manages over 2,800 buildings. And you can see these building locations on the map that's in front of you. There are 225 work sites. Sorry, that's what's actually on the map. We don't have a map of all of the buildings for you today, but that can be arranged if you're interested. And within all of the DNR buildings that we manage, there are about 30,000 different building components, which includes HVAC and furnaces and all of the different pieces that are required to run a building. How we determine our needs. So with these 2,800 buildings and all of the lands and everything that's out there on the ground, we're continuously assessing our assets to identify our needs. Our deferred maintenance need is too large to address all at once. And so the governor's proposal also reflects the DNR 10-year approach. We have a document called Taking Care of What We Have. It can be found on our website. If anyone's interested in a copy, please let me know and I can get that to the committee. As of December 2018, our deferred maintenance, which has been annualized over 10 years, is $44.6 million. The annual renewal and replacement of the assets and components is $111 million. And our annual natural resource asset preservation need is $155.6 million. And this is something that's continually changing over as we find out new things about our buildings and as we continue to assess the state of the buildings. This slide provides a high-level overview of our bonding package. The governor's request for DNR is $196.3 million. And similar to previous years, our greatest and most important need is the Natural Resource Asset Preservation Program and other DNR programs. There's a lot of detail in our request, so as the chair mentioned at the beginning of committee, we don't plan on walking through project by project or program by program. We've identified several themes that we'll use to present this. There's many elements of our bonding package that impact water quality and management. This could include hatcheries, public water accesses, reforestation, and even trails and roads, but today I'm going to keep it to things that are directly related to water and wastewater infrastructure. So that's what we'll be focusing on. But really, all of our packages somehow tie into water. Next, I will discuss the key components as they relate to water and wastewater systems. There are many aging wastewater systems and water systems in our state parks throughout Minnesota, many of which do not meet current health or environmental standards. Priorities for these wastewater systems in our state parks include Myrie Big Island, Father Hennepin, Itasca, and Scenic State Park. These sites, these state park systems, are like small cities. Many of the systems date back to the 1950s, and many have reached the end of their designed service life. Emergency repairs are increasingly needed to keep facilities open to the public. A separate capital budget request is our flood hazard mitigation grant. This request is, I skipped one, sorry. Water control structures. This is also under the natural resource asset preservation. Our water control structures are deteriorating and require repair and replacement to maintain the existing investments in the state's fish and wildlife resources. Typical life expectancy of these structures is 30 to 40 years, and almost one third of the control structures that are out there have exceeded their life expectancy. Now I will talk about the flood hazard mitigation grant program. As I was saying, the request for this program is $20 million. The DNR proposal provides grants to address flood risk reduction projects, and the grants are used for projects such as purchasing and removing damaged and at-risk residential structures from the floodplain and construction of levees, pumping stations, and multi-purpose flood impoundments. Dam safety, this is the final category that I'll be discussing in DNR's needs portfolio for bonding requests. The DNR maintains the structural integrity of dams to prevent public safety hazards and maintain water levels on lakes and rivers. Most publicly owned dams are more than 50 years old. The priority list to repair and rehabilitate these dams is based on danger to life and property, and that's how they are ranked and categorized. The estimated cost to rehabilitate the 644 publicly owned dams over the next 20 years is $100 million, and the highest priority that we're looking at right now is Lake Bronson, which is a high-hazard dam. High-hazard dams pose risk of loss of life or serious economic loss if failure were to occur, and the estimate to replace this particular dam is approximately $20 million. Or thereabouts, so that will take up the bulk of, if it goes through, that will take up the bulk of the request for DNR's dam program. That concludes my presentation on DNR's water-related bonding requests. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. I also want to point out that we've included a packet of our, kind of a summary, a high-level summary of our bonding requests for you, for the reference.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Garlitz. Are there any questions? Hearing none, thank you. And then next we have Mr. Colvin from the Met Council, who will be giving us a presentation.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Colvin. You may go ahead.
All right. For the record, my name is Kyle Colvin. I am a manager in the Engineering Programs Group at the Metropolitan Council in the Environmental Services Division. Environmental Services is that division of the Metropolitan Council that is responsible for regional wastewater collection and treatment services. Also, the Engineering Programs Group has been the group responsible for administering previous INI grant bond funds that were included in the budget. Okay. Most of you know and are aware the council's role in regional wastewater service in the seven-county metropolitan area. The council is a provider of wholesale wastewater services to 110 communities. Which reflects service to a little over 2.7 million people, which is nearly half of the state's entire population. We own and operate 9 wastewater treatment plants, also operate over 610 miles of interceptors, and we treat on average 250 million gallons per day and have an annual capital program of about $150 million. Aging wastewater infrastructure is a significant challenge for communities in the region, and repairs can be costly. As infrastructure ages, it can lead to more clear water entering the wastewater collection and treatment systems. This clear water is referred to as inflow and infiltration, or I&I, and it refers to the two methods in which clear water can enter the wastewater collection system. By itself, this clear water doesn't require treatment, but once it enters the wastewater collection system, it commingles and therefore needs to be treated as part of the wastewater. Excessive amounts of I&I can utilize reserve system capacity and in some instances can exceed the system's capacity and lead to sewage backups into basements and spills into the open environment. The $5 million bond funds would provide grants to communities for locally owned wastewater infrastructure work related to I&I mitigation improvements. There are generally three systems in the wastewater collection system. There's the private system, which is that portion of the system between the house and the municipal system. The municipal system, generally located in the street that fronts properties, collects the water from the private system and conveys it to the regional system, and then the regional system, which the council is responsible for in the seven county area, then conveys that flow to one of our nine treatment plants that I alluded to earlier, in which it gets treated to regulatory standards, permit standards, and then gets discharged into receiving waters. Grant funds under this bonding bill would only be used for that work on the municipal or privately owned infrastructure. Eligible communities are identified by the Metropolitan Council under its regional I&I mitigation program as having having excess clear water flow in its system, or those communities that are within 20% of discharging their allowable limit into the regional system. The council uses its existing network of wastewater flow meters to measure a community's flow and identify excess I&I and assigns I&I reduction work plans as part of the council's program. Grants can be used to fund up to 50% of the total I&I mitigation costs associated with a project. Remaining costs must be covered by other local sources. There are currently 80 communities within the regional wastewater service area that have been identified as being impacted by I&I. These communities would be eligible for grant funding. I need to point out that there's an error in this slide. After the presentation was submitted to the committee, I realized that the city of Spring Park actually appears twice on the list. So there are 80 communities that are on being identified as having excess I&I in the system.
We're happy to be represented twice. That's okay.
Right. The council uses a two-step distribution process for allocating the grants. After notifying all eligible communities of the availability of the grant and receiving the applications, the council reviews the applications for project eligibility regarding I&I mitigation elements and determines total I&I related project costs. Then the council will establish a minimum award amount based on the distribution of all eligible I&I costs. This ensures that all applicants receive at least some funding level. Many of the smaller projects that come in for funding are fully funded at the maximum amount through this first part of the distribution process. Then the second allocation process then takes the balance of the grant funds and then distributes it proportionately based on the total remaining need of the applications that are submitted. So for instance, if through the first pass, we utilize 20% of the total bond funding source, then the rest of the projects would be funded at that 80%. 100% of the grants are passed through to local communities, and the council does not use any grant funds to administer the program. Funding local infrastructure rehabilitation efforts that target sources of excess I&I supports local community activities and the regional I&I mitigation program. It protects public health by preserving system capacity, thereby avoiding backups of sewage and basements and protects water quality by avoiding spills into lakes, rivers, and streams. And it avoids unnecessary expansion of sewers and treatment plants that, if made, would be utilized intermittently only during wet weather events. There have been positive impacts from the local and regional efforts on INI reduction. Since the start of the program in 2004, total regional wastewater flow has decreased a little over 3%. Now, this might not sound significant, but when you consider the impact that wet weather has had, as Ms. Katrina had pointed out earlier, the system, the area has seen about a 20% increase in precipitation, which puts added pressure on the collection system if there's excess INI in it. And also, during that time period, population growth in the region has increased by 10%. So the reduction in flow has been more than offset that growth in population and INI due to increased precipitation. I think maybe with that, I would just close. I would like to draw your attention. There is a one-page information sheet, I believe, in your packet that goes into more detail about how the council has administered past INI grants through bonding bills. We've had historically grants in 2010, 12, 14, 17, and 18. And also another interesting fact that for every dollar of bonding grant money that has been awarded, that has leveraged a total of about $8.50 in total project costs. So with that, I can answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Colvin. Are there any questions? Okay, not seeing any questions. Thank you for coming forward.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And at this point, then, we'll move on to the next part. We do have Executive Director Jim Stark from the LCC Subcommittee on Water, who will be coming down to give us an overview of a number of bills that will be coming forward from the Subcommittee on Water, which several of us serve on. I know Representative Torkelson, Representative Heinzman, and myself serve on this illustrious subcommittee.
Chair and members, good afternoon. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to come talk to you today about the work of the Legislative Subcommittee on Water Policy. Just a brief note about the membership of this bicameral committee. Senator Weber is the co-chair in the Senate. Senate members are Senator Dreheim, Eaton, Eakin, Goggin, and Uyghur. In the House, Representative Fisher is the co-chair. The other members are Representative Brand, Heintzman, Lippert, Poston, and Torkelson. I want to talk today about the subcommittee recommendations. The legislative recommendations are built based on subcommittee suggestions from other legislators, constituents, discussions with the state agencies, and a series of stakeholder workshops that the subcommittee held over the summer. Most of these topics are now in bill form. Bills are in process. There are some of the others which we're following or discussing as emerging issues, which I won't really talk about today. Some of these will lead to budget requests during the next cycle. We will discuss issues today that have draft bills, and they're referenced by number in this rather large handout that you have here. So the first page is simply a listing by number of the topics, some of which we'll discuss today. The bills generally involve minimal or small amounts of funding. But they do involve generally plans, pilots, and reports to the legislature that would set the stage for larger programs of significance during the next budget cycle. They lay, in fact, then lay the groundwork for the future. The subcommittee members went through a process of prioritizing the recommendations that came out of our stakeholder process. This graph simply shows you that process, how we prioritize them by member. And if you look at the green on these by topic, you see the topics that had the greatest support. Those in yellow had support, but not of the greatest level, and the boxes in blue by each one of the members were topics that had less support. So there are about 25 of these, and they're listed by priority. I think I'll go through just the top 10 very, very briefly this afternoon, and then you can look at the rest of those topics. You have questions about them. I can answer them on any of those topics that are listed. Briefly, I will just go through the top 10. And these, again, are in priority order. The first issue pertains to addressing soil and water conservation district funding needs. Compensation. Soil and water conservation districts need stable funding that does not rely as much as it does on clean water funds. This bill calls for a phased-in reduction from the clean water fund and performance narratives balanced by a phased reduction of increase from the general fund. The second topic deals with agricultural buffers. Farm organizations have proposed in the past compensations for lands lost for stream buffers. This bill proposes a tax credit for lost lands. The third topic is drinking water safety for private well owners. Private well owners really need help in protecting the safety of the drinking waters that they get from their private wells. This bill would fund the development of an educational program for future implementation for well owner safety through a legislative report for a plan. It also contains a requirement for well testing during property sale. The fourth topic involves wastewater management. Cities struggle to maintain wastewater infrastructure. This bill establishes regional wastewater coordinator positions at the MPCA to assist cities with training and innovative wastewater practices. It provides funding for low-income households in fixing leaking septic systems, and it provides support for the preparation of a plan at the University of Minnesota to encourage innovations in wastewater options. The fifth topic is about healthy soil. Improving soil is good for agricultural productivity and for water quality. This bill provides support for soil health programs at the University of Minnesota. It would include the preparation of a plan for a statewide soil health action plan, as well as research, outreach, and implementation to improve soil health. The sixth topic deals with sustainable and safe drinking water for the future. As a state, we need to plan for safe and adequate drinking water. The Minnesota Geological Survey and the Department of Natural Resources groundwater atlas programs are seen as a success because they provide what's needed for enhanced drinking water protection statewide. Because of the program is processing across the state and getting to a point of being near completion across the state, it really provides what's needed. But there's an opportunity to apply emerging technology to put together that information into a complete statewide digital database. This database would be a powerful tool in completing, it would be a powerful tool for managing aquifers and watersheds across county boundaries. The bill simply allows for the development of a plan for implementation to meet future groundwater management needs of the state for the future. The bill also contains plans to increase monitoring education to well owners where aquifers that supply groundwater to domestic wells are vulnerable. This would include the development of a sentinel well network that could be used to document trends and changes in water quality over time at the Departments of Health and Agriculture. The seventh topic is about salt. We overuse salt and it degrades the waters of the state. This bill would protect our waters by providing applicator training. It would also provide funds to identify sources of salt other than road salt and to evaluate reduction strategies. The eighth issue is about Minnesota's drinking water infrastructure. Minnesota's infrastructure for drinking water is aging and threatens the health and the economy of the nation, of the country and state. This bill would produce a plan to increase cost effectiveness reviews, alternative best management practices, asset management and reviews, and efficient infrastructure alternatives for cities. The ninth one is about forever chemicals. The PFAS and PFAS chemicals, the forever chemicals in food packaging, threaten the composting industry and present a threat to organic recycling. The bill provides minimal funding and policy to support the continuation of the food composting industry and continued recycling of food waste. This would include water sampling at some selected composting sites and a temporary ban on the composting of food packaging. And the 10th one is about groundwater recharge. As a state, we need policy to allow an increase groundwater recharge in priority locations. Artificial recharge is a common practice in many states. However, in Minnesota, the practice is generally discouraged and without firm policy. The legislature is currently funding a project to explore expanded recharge in specific areas. In order to capitalize on that project and on that study, as well as the benefits of recharge, the state really needs policy to allow and encourage that practice with proper cautions. And with that, I think, there are many more of these. There are about twice this number again. Again, I've gone through them in priority order. I think at this point, I will stop. And if you have questions about any of these in particular, I'd be happy to try to answer those.
Okay. First of all, Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifier, I see number one is on your list, is number one on my list as well. Soil and Water Conservation District funding mechanisms. There's absolutely room for improvement on that. I'm just wondering if you touched on another possibility of authorizing levy authority to the Soil and Water Conservation Districts. Those people are elected officials in our communities, and the public can hold them accountable. So I'm just wondering if there's discussion about granting levy authority to the districts.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for that question. The topic of levy authority has been part of the discussion in the past. It's not included in the language for the bill at this point, but could certainly be open for discussion and amendment at a hearing.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. And I see some excitement over on the other side of the table at that suggestion there. I know this is something that we've talked about quite a bit at the Subcommittee on Water. It's critical that we figure out the best way to make sure we have sustainable funding for these great organizations going forward. Representative Claflin.
Thank you, Chair. Jumping way to the end of the pamphlet that you have given us, I have a question about recommendation 34, the disclosure of wells to buyers. I don't see a page with that information in the packet. Can you get that to the committee members, please?
Mr. Stark.
Mr. Chair and Representative, could you repeat the question, please?
I was looking for the recommendation 34, the disclosure of wells to buyers, and don't see that information in the packet.
Mr. Chair, members. Yes, thank you for that. It was kind of a late development in the process. It was included in one of the other bills, and the language has been split up into another bill. Be happy to provide that language to you.
It'd be great if we could get that for us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Other questions? I will mention to the committee that you might want to hang on to this packet here, because almost everything you're seeing on here at some point, most of these are, a lot of these are jacketed, and they'll start coming through the process. As they're introduced, the bills will make their way through this committee and then go out and then move on from there. So it might be a good reference to have. Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. It strikes me as somewhat ironic that on a list of water policy, we have the promotion of mining, which is a known pollutant of water. And I'm wondering if there's a distinction between kind of mining.
Mr. Stark.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the intent of that bill, and that bill was brought forward by a member of the House here, and it's in response to that, is really to try to provide the University of Minnesota at the NRRI facility in Duluth with funds to do research and planning for mining that's sustainable and that is environmental, it recognizes the environmental consequences of the activities we do.
Thank you.
Representative Morrison, anything else?
No, thanks.
Okay. Any other questions that anyone would have at this point in time?
No.
Hearing none, Mr. Stark, thank you for coming forward today. Appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
And we've reached the end of our time, or we're close to the end of our time. Is there any other issues that people would like to bring forward at this point? Hearing none, I will declare the meeting adjourned. Thank you.